From KCUR News, this is KC Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Alex Smith. Susan Wilson is away this week. On today's show, hear how the International House of Prayer is impacting the town of Grandview.
When the foreclosure crisis hit, we had a lot of empty houses around us. So this was probably right around 2008, 2009. We saw those houses start to be filling up with, quite frankly, a lot of families that were coming here from IHOP.
Hear the final installment in a series on the privatization of Medicaid in Kansas.
5% of our patients cost us 70% of the money. If you can intervene effectively with those patients, that's the goal.
Plus, a local postcard collection takes us back in time to Kansas City in the 30s and 40s.
The golden age of postcards coincidentally coincides with the golden age of Kansas City.
Listen up for KC Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Alex Smith. KC Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
For most of the past couple of decades, residents of the town of Grandview have been praying for a miracle. The population was aging, retail space sat empty, and the town desperately needed new employers. But the explosion of a controversial evangelical group has been changing Grandview's outlook dramatically. This town of 25,000 is now facing an unexpectedly bright future, thanks to an unlikely savior. Alex Smith has the story.
In the final hours of 2012, thousands of mostly teens and early 20-somethings crowded the huge Bartle Hall Convention Center to hear songwriter Tim Reimer sing out in anticipation of the return of Christ. Almost everyone in the room, including the event ushers, sang along with every word. Thousands of hands waved in the air and tears streamed down faces as bodies swayed, jumped, or danced. It was day 4 of the International House of Prayer's Free One Thing Conference. The annual conference brought diverse and wildly enthusiastic followers from across the country and beyond to be a part of the concerts, teachings, and undeniably electric atmosphere. Out in the street, a few of the approximately 20,000 attendees explained what brought them to downtown Kansas City.
I'm Jessica. I came to the conference just kind of wanting to get refreshed in my faith and just wanting to kind of be immersed in a place where everyone's praising God, and to kind of realign myself with that.
I'm Elise Reardon. All the speakers are amazing, and they have a great way about reaching out to teenagers and just showing you how awesome Jesus is.
I'm Jackie Jordan from Cincinnati, Ohio. I actually don't have a lot of friends that are Christians in Cincinnati, and that's why I came here to fellowship with people.
I'm CJ Pendergast. You can just feel God with you when you're here. It's awesome.
The One Thing Conference may be the highlight of their calendar, but for several years now, the non-denominational International House of Prayer has been drawing increasing numbers of people to the southeast Kansas City area to visit or even live. And many in Grandview say the group is reviving their struggling town. In 2007, Grandview's new economic development director, Alan Kenyon, was charged with bringing more business to a town with few prospects. Back in 1994, one of the town's major economic drivers, Richards Gebauer Air Force Base, had closed, and the town had seen a steady decline ever since. But Alan Kenyon heard about one group, a small religious organization that was actually growing in Grandview. He received an invitation to visit the International House of Prayer's prayer room and was surprised to see an impassioned 24/7 musical worship service happening in a former strip mall just a few miles from City Hall.
The more I looked, and it's like, well, it's more intense than what I personally may have experienced or could do, frankly, but I don't see any danger here.
In September of 1999, Pastor Mike Bickle started a musical worship service in Grandview, which has continued nonstop ever since. In 2007, the International House of Prayer, or IHOP as it's usually called, began streaming the worship service live on its website and quickly found itself with legions of national and international followers. A year after that, IHOP started developing plans for a university to train future missionaries at a state-of-the-art campus in Grandview, and IHOP U finally opened in 2010. Andrea Wood, who's the former owner and editor of the Jackson County Advocate, says an influx of new people who came to be part of IHOP saved her economically vulnerable town from the worst of the recession.
I've lived in Grandview for most of my life, and when the foreclosure crisis hit, we had a lot of empty houses around us. So this was probably right around 2008, 2009. We saw those houses start to be filling up with, quite frankly, a lot of families that were coming here from IHOP. Families, college-age kids.
Today, Grandview is home to about 3,500 IHOPers. As an economic booster, the group has won a lot of friends, but it's also attracted attention for some of its unusual beliefs and practices. IHOP teaches that through prayer, followers can accelerate the second coming of Christ. Founder Mike Bickle has said this will probably happen during the lifetimes of the group's largely college-age membership. The end times will mean the death of billions, as well as supernatural disasters like the seas turning to blood. IHOP teaches this will not be the end of the world. Senior leader Luis Cataldo says the second coming will be a time of justice.
We believe that the shakings that are happening in the earth, militarily, politically, economically, morally, a just God cannot just turn his back on that and say, well, good luck, you guys. Work it out yourselves. Let me know when you got it all together. At the same time, we believe that God is going to intervene to bring justice as a righteous judge. And he's going to do it using his church all over the earth.
Some Grandview residents and former IHOP members accuse the organization of being a cult. These critics worry about the effect IHOP has on its impressionable young followers. IHOP has addressed this by hosting open houses and even talking about it at their conferences. Luis Cataldo responds to the critics by saying that IHOP encourages critical thought.
We always say around here the truth has nothing to fear from investigation and analysis. And so we are so transparent in everything that we do here. Because we're broadcast live 24/7, because all of our teachers' teachings are recorded, everything's open to the public all the time, we welcome the scrutiny of folks that are looking at our theology, at our doctrine, at our practices.
IHOP has also brought criticism for its belief in what's called conversion therapy. Conversion therapy is designed to change the sexual orientation of gays and lesbians. The therapy has been condemned by gay rights groups and the American Psychiatric Association. It's also currently facing a ban in California. But IHOP teaches that gays and lesbians can be changed through prayer.
We believe that like lots of sin, that God intends to restore us, that God has a way to bring healing, to bring wholeness, to bring love to people. And so for sure, homosexuality would fall within that, just like a murderer, just like a proud person, just like somebody who struggles with stealing. Sin is sin from God's perspective, and he is a restorer of human beings and one who wants to bring wholeness and healing to people.
IHOP members now make up about 13% of Grandview's population, and Andrea Wood says the newcomers are changing the political climate of her hometown.
The members that are coming here tend to be more politically conservative, and it is creating a voting bloc here in Grandview that didn't exist before, whereas it was just an assumption that if you're a Democrat, you might not even have anyone running against you. Now you're seeing more and more Republican candidates that, you know, are stepping up and putting their names on the ballot, and some are tied to IHOP. But anyway, all of this is new on Main Street. They've revitalized the downtown. And
on a recent drive through town, Andrea IHOP shows how IHOP is now everywhere. You can't drive for more than a few blocks through most of Grandview without seeing an IHOP office or related business. In fact, two separate real estate companies, Gladheart Realty and Rentals Near IHOP, have been started to help IHOPers relocate here. Several apartment complexes in Grandview are occupied almost entirely by IHOP members, and more apartment buildings are planned. Developers have already pre-sold almost every lot in a planned subdivision near the site of IHOP's future headquarters. Luis Cataldo says that IHOP sees Grandview as its partner in growth.
We want to be good neighbors, and we want to be good citizens of this little community that the Lord has us in. And so we want to know what are the dreams of the leaders of Grandview? And we want to partner with them in their dreams for this town.
IHOP has been raising money for its new headquarters for several years, but says it still needs more funding before it can begin construction. For Casey Currents, this is Alex Smith.
By now, you've heard about how the 2012 drought hurt corn and soybean crops, but the lack of water and high temperatures also delivered a pricey punch to U.S. aquaculture, the business of raising fish, like bass and catfish. Worldwide, aquaculture has grown into a $119 billion industry. But as Christopher Husted reports for Harvest Public Media, the drought hurt U.S. fish farmers already struggling to compete on a global scale.
Dozens of rectangular ponds with rounded corners sit about 1 mile off the highway here in rural central Missouri. Some of them are empty, some have water, but not one is completely full.
This unit here is a catfish production unit, fingerlings. These fish are average 8 to 12 inches long.
Steve Kars dons a pair of shorts on an unusually warm December day and surveys his ponds. Today, the water is fairly still with a few ripples from the warm breeze. He points to the dirty rings circling up a white PVC pipe for about a foot before it becomes white again.
They're out of the water a ways. Now, our average depth in this unit is probably still about 5 feet, but we're a good 10 to 12 inches down where we usually would keep it.
Kars is the co-owner of Osage Cat Fisheries in Osage Beach, Missouri. Carr's office sits in a small house next to two tiny ponds where his father first started raising fish more than 60 years ago. Scattered about the property are sinks and large tubs filled with catfish, bluegill, and paddlefish. Carr says the 2012 drought proved to be a tough one on the family business, one that sorely depends on water.
We did fall short on our production numbers that we wanted.
The dry conditions and high temperatures forced many fish farmers here to dig deep to keep their fish healthy and hungry. For Kars, that meant paying for more energy to pump clean, cool water out of his wells and into the ponds around the clock.
We probably chewed through about another 30% more power than we did the year before, and the year before was not that good.
It wasn't just the water level either. The soaring temperatures in the summer turned up the burner on the ponds. When that happens, oxygen levels in the water drop, and the fish's metabolism slows down. To counteract this, Kars says he was pumping water nearly every day from April through September. Farmers also saw the price of fish feed shoot up because it contains fish meal, soybean, and corn.
I would say we've probably seen an increase per ton over the last 4 years of probably close to $80 to $100. And we saw a huge jump just this summer of, I think it was like $16 or $17 a ton, which, you know, there's only so long before you have to pass that along.
I think in 2001 there was something like 113,000 acres or so, and now there's like 50,000.
That's John Hargreaves, a former aquaculture professor at Mississippi State University who now consults for global aquaculture development projects. He says the rising production costs of fish farming, erratic weather, and a less expensive type of catfish from Asia have all hurt the catfish industry here, essentially cutting it in half.
Production is down, and one of the big drivers for that was the increase in imports of Pangasius catfish from places like Vietnam and China and so forth. So those imports have basically substituted for domestic catfish.
In 2010, 20% of U.S. catfish farms shut down, and that was before the crushing drought. So what can fish farmers do to survive the stiff competition and spells of inhospitable weather? Some researchers have been looking into modifying the pond system to make it more energy efficient. Others are experimenting with new feed recipes requiring less expensive ingredients. But Hargreaves says even that might not be enough to save this domestic industry.
There's no silver bullet or game changer out there, that's for certain.
In the meantime, Steve Kars plans to repurpose at least 20 acres of catfish ponds to raise other species like paddlefish and bass. He hopes they'll be more lucrative. But most of all, he's hoping for a solid snowpack this winter and lots of rain in the spring. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Christopher Husted.
Coming up long before tweets or Facebook, we had postcards. A local exhibit takes us back to an earlier time. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Alex Smith, sitting in for Susan Wilson.
Now that the new CanCare program is in effect, Kansans who rely on Medicaid are depending on private insurance companies to pay for their care. But will these companies live up to their contractual obligations? In the fifth part of a series on CanCare, Kansas Public Radio's Brian Thompson takes a closer look at these contracts.
The Brownback administration says the three insurance companies awarded a share of the state's Medicaid business are not allowed to reduce eligibility for the program. Anyone eligible under the old system remains eligible. Doctors and other providers have to be paid at least as much for their services as they have been in the past. And the companies are not allowed to cut back on the benefits to patients. Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier says the state has what he calls a big stick to enforce those terms in the form of the contracts signed by each of the managed care organizations, or MCOs.
And that big stick is, we're holding back $500 million over the next few years, and we're looking for results. For good outcomes, for good behavior. And they don't have an out clause. We have control.
Collier is predicting that CanCare will save the state of Kansas $1 billion over the next 5 years.
I mean, the state's math is right. If they actually get the MCOs to perform at the level indicated in those quality indicators, the state will save that much money.
That's Marty Ross. She's an attorney now working as a healthcare consultant in suburban Kansas City. Ross has been helping hospitals, health departments, mental health centers, and safety net clinics evaluate their provider contracts with the managed care organizations, the MCOs. She says it's much too soon to predict whether this new system will work as billed.
The request for proposal, which is the backbone of the CanCare program, certainly has numerous provisions that are intended to protect both providers and beneficiaries. The question will be how those are interpreted by the state and the MCOs and how aggressive the state will be in enforcing those provisions.
Under CanCare, the contractors will be paid a little more than $500 per patient per month to cover all of their health care needs. That's about $1 billion a year for each company. The concept here is simple. Keep Medicaid recipients as healthy as possible by managing their care and minimize the need for expensive hospital stays. But Ross says it's possible that the companies will try to keep costs down by denying coverage for some treatments. She says the contracts aren't specific about which services are medically necessary.
Now for the MCO, I'm paid on a per member per month basis. I want to manage the level of service this person receives because my profit is the difference between the amount I receive from the state and the amount I pay out from the providers. So I now have an incentive to try and keep the services in check. That's the cheap way to savings, is you just squeeze out services.
Ross isn't saying the contractors will do that, just that it's a potential source of what she calls mischief. She also worries whether the care coordination that's supposed to help patients by getting all their providers to work together will amount to more than just window dressing.
You know, having phone a nurse, you know, somewhere up in Wisconsin or something. You know, 24-hour access to a nurse who doesn't know anything about you. That's great. Versus someone stationed locally who takes responsibility for high-dollar patients. 5% of our patients cost us 70% of the money. And if you can intervene effectively with those patients, that's the goal. And the more you can do that locally, the better.
Ross says keeping patients on track with their care plans is where the real savings are to be found in CanCare. But here, too, the contracts lack specifics about how care is to be coordinated. In some states, one of the big problems has been failure to pay providers in a timely fashion. Ross points to the findings of a Kentucky state audit as an example of what can go wrong.
Something like the state had paid out $740 million but the MCOs had only paid the providers somewhere south of $500 million. And so they're riding the interest wave on $200 million. That's $200 million the providers don't have in their pockets.
That kind of experience can prompt doctors and other medical providers to pull out of the Medicaid system altogether. That, in turn, makes it more difficult for patients to get the care they need. This is where the holdback of $500 million that Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier referred to earlier comes into play. The contractors are required to process claims within 30 days. But if they want to receive the so-called pay-for-performance bonus, those claims must be processed in 20 days. Ross says it's a powerful incentive.
Assuming that they have built their models around achieving the pay-for-performance indicators, they are significantly at risk. That's 3 to 5% of their take from the state. These are billion-dollar contracts. That's a lot of money.
In the first year of the contract, companies earn those bonuses by hitting administrative milestones. But Ross says to collect the performance incentives in years 2 and 3, the companies will have to show that they're improving the care they're providing to patients. Once again, Ross says the contracts aren't specific enough to be airtight. Beyond the financial incentives to make CanCare work, Ross sees another motivating factor, the political fortunes of Governor Sam Brownback and his administration.
They have planted the stake in the ground, and they are putting their political future in on that. And so there's going to be a lot of pressure on these MCOs to perform.
Some observers wonder whether the three companies have committed to more than they can deliver and remain profitable. Sheldon Weisgrau heads the nonprofit Health Reform Resource Project.
If they're not able to squeeze out the level of savings they believe, then the contracts they've signed with the state aren't going to be sufficient to support their costs, and they're going to have to come back to the state and ask to renegotiate.
Weisgrau says the companies have a right to do that. Then the state would have to choose between increasing the payment rate or letting them out of the contract. In the end, CanCare is a multi-billion dollar gamble. The state has now rolled the dice, but it'll take months, maybe even years, to find out whether their bet pays off. I'm Brian Thompson, Kansas Public Radio.
To find out more about CanCare or hear the rest of the CanCare series from Kansas Public Radio, go to the Casey Currents page of our website at kcur.org.
Longtime readers of the Kansas City Star and Times may remember a column by a woman named Mrs. Sam Ray. The columns always featured commentary and a reproduction of an old postcard from Mrs. Ray's vast collection of cards. They were usually intricately colored historical images of mansions, municipal buildings, industry, and civic life of our town. Today, the cards live in the Missouri Valley Special Collections of the Kansas City Public Library. An exhibit of these postcards called Greetings from Kansas City opens this week at the library. Curator Eli Paul told KCOR's Laura Ziegler that he thinks the show would be something Mrs. Sam Ray would be proud of.
One that really shows the golden age of postcards, which coincidentally coincides with the golden age of Kansas City. Thousands of people passed through Union Station every day. They needed a place to stay, which was the hotels downtown. They needed a place to shop, which were some of the great department stores in our history. And postcards captured so many of those sites.
It was also a way that people could say, hey, look where I am. I mean, cities were relatively new, and people that were coming in from the countryside may want people to see the theaters, the shopping, the civic life. It was sort of a way to brag about civic pride and about where you were going.
In fact, that's one of the themes of our exhibition, looking at these postcards as examples of civic pride. They're not only pride by the people who live in Kansas City, but also pieces of wonderment and amazement that visitors to Kansas City were sending back home. Kansas City at its best, at its most exciting, at its most colorful.
About postcards is that people tended to write in shorter sentences, sort of more clipped messages. Here's one how is my boy with love, Papa? And others that reflect a kind of change in writing style.
This has been called by some people postcardese, which means that it was almost a new way of communicating. It was abbreviated, abrupt sentences, sometimes switching from one topic to another. In fact, this was such a change from the letter writing of the Victorian era that some people called in the question that Americans were losing their ability to write clearly.
Why does that sound so familiar?
Well, it is quite familiar, and it's another reason why in some ways these types of messages really resonate today, because we can see you have a very small area in which to write a message. You're trying to get across the most important points, and you take shortcuts to do that. And they were doing this 100 years ago on the back of a penny postcard.
Okay, I want you to tell me about some of these beautiful old homes and neighborhoods.
Now you get postcards of individual homes, sometimes a person's own home, and you start getting down to the idea of pride in the sense of, look at us, we are very prosperous here.
Okay, we're talking about homes. Here we are with hotels, and there definitely are some recognizable buildings here. The Aladdin Hotel downtown, and again, that's one of these buildings that's standing there now. Now it's surrounded by other buildings in development. The Savoy, were all those rooms in the hotel?
Those were rooms. Kansas City was so dense in terms of the downtown, so people coming into town through Union Station were being funneled north to the downtown where so many hotels were located. Dozens and dozens of hotels, and large hotels at that.
City, the Cowtown.
Yes, you can tell that Cowtown was not a pejorative term at this time. People were very proud of this because, as a point of civic pride, we only had Chicago ahead of us in terms of the size of our stockyards and the amount of business that we were doing in the livestock and food production area.
So 20,000 cattle a day passed through these stockyards, I read.
And how do we know that? That's on the back of a postcard that was sold that shows the Kansas City stockyards with just dozens of pens that are just teeming with cattle. It tells you what you're looking at. This is a view of, and I quote, portion of cattle yards looking southwest from livestock exchange building. That was a great source of pride to the city. It was finished in 1911. It had dozens and dozens of offices there. It had its own post office. It had its own barber shop. It was sort of a city within a city there that handled all the needs of the people doing business down at the stockyards. It's now on the National Register. It's a very important structure in the history of Kansas City.
Here we have a panel that reflects, of course, the related industry of transportation, rivers and trains.
This really started with the building of the Hannibal Bridge in 1869, which is the subject of a turn-of-the-century postcard here. But when that opened up in 1869, it basically made possible the Kansas City stockyards. You can see Kansas City was so exquisitely located to take advantage of this new railroad bridge, to take advantage of the Missouri River, which passed by. And later on, with Union Station really becoming an even more important railroad hub for the entire central part of the United States.
Finally, I'm curious what we may have lost when we lost the art of writing postcards. Here we are in an age of email and Facebook and Twitter, as particularly for our young people, their primary mode of communication. What would you say, based on your research and putting this exhibit together, we've lost with this art of the postcard?
Well, in some ways, we may have not lost a lot in the sense of we're still sending messages, and we're still sending messages with visuals. What we have lost is anyone going to be looking at our messages 100 years from now? Obviously, on a piece of cardboard that has survived for a century, we can look back at our ancestors and get a glimpse of their life. But are we going to be leaving that same type of message to later generations?
Curator Eli Paul spoke to KCUR's Laura Ziegler about the postcards that make up the exhibit Greetings from Kansas City. Paul will talk about the show on Wednesday evening at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. See the KC Currents page of our website for images of some of the historical cards.
If you can't listen to all of KC Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
With the hiring of general manager John Dorsey and head coach Andy Reid, the Kansas City Chiefs are ushering in what they hope will be more successful days ahead. The change officially closes the curtain on the tumultuous four-year Scott Pioli era, as KCUR's Greg Eklund reports.
We thank you for attending Fan Appreciation Day at Arrowhead Stadium.
By the time the final seconds ticked away for the last home game at Arrowhead last month, the stadium had already emptied. There was very little to cheer about. It didn't sit well with Clark Hunt, the Kansas City Chiefs chairman of the board.
I don't want to say that there was any one moment where I said I have to do something about it, but clearly when you're not successful in the National Football League, it's a certainty that change is coming.
Hunt figured he had the right combination when the duo of general manager Scott Pioli and coach Todd Haley came aboard. Here is what Hunt said 4 years ago.
Most importantly, we were looking for a head coach who could partner with Scott to build the Chiefs into a championship organization.
During the early days of the Pioli tenure, one of the catchphrases associated with him caught on quickly.
There's different times for different parts of the process.
The process. It started with the acquisition of quarterback Matt Cassel from the New England Patriots, where previously Pioli was part of three Super Bowl championships. But that success hardly carried over to Kansas City. After two losing seasons in the first 3 years, Pioli's highest-profile pickup never caught on as a popular figure in Kansas City. Cassel was even booed during a celebrity softball game as part of last summer's All-Star festivities at Kauffman Stadium. While the infusion of rookie quarterbacks turned around other teams, Pioli stuck with Cassel. Another Pioli catchphrase was finding, quote, the right 53 for the Chiefs' 53-man roster.
When you go through the evaluation process, again, there's the evaluation process and the strategy. When you go through the evaluation process, you look at the full body of work.
Pioli said that when the Chiefs drafted John Baldwin 2 years ago, after Baldwin brought with him the reputation of trouble with his teammates at the University of Pittsburgh. During Baldwin's rookie season with the Chiefs, he injured his arm in a Chiefs locker room fight and missed several games. Pioli didn't mix very well with his head coach either, and after 2.5 seasons, fired Haley.
We're clearly not at a spot where we need to be with our record the way it is and with us being in the position that we're in. So clearly, I need to do my job better as well.
Pioli chose Romeo Crennel to take over for the rest of the 2011 season and named him as the permanent coach for 2012. The season proved to be disastrous, and in the midst of it, even tragic, with linebacker Javon Belcher committing murder, then suicide. The Chiefs marked their 50th anniversary in Kansas City as one of their most forgettable seasons at 2-14. But while Pioli lived in Kansas City, he made no secret about his appreciation for the local arts scene. He told KCUR's Laura Spencer about his previous experience of watching a rehearsal of the Cleveland Orchestra.
The whole thing has fascinated me. I've watched other people build teams, so to speak, in other areas of greatness.
However, he was never able to pull off the greatness he had hoped for on the football field in Kansas City. In his departing statement last week, Pioli issued a public apology. The bottom line, the statement said, is that I did not accomplish all of what I set out to do. Greg Eklund, KCUR News.
After the break, a new classical composition influenced by the works of art at the Nelson. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Alex Smith. Susan Wilson is away. In area news this week, Kansas's governor spoke out against abortions and property tax deductions. Missouri's governor took heat from the legislature about the purchase of an airplane. And the president of the Missouri Board of Education resigned. KCUR's Steve Bell looks back on those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
The new president of the Missouri Board of Education, Stan Archie of Kansas City, turned in his resignation on Friday. Archie is facing lawsuits from two women who accuse him of sexual improprieties while acting in his role as pastor of the Christian Fellowship Baptist Church. Archie denies the accusations. Jackson County Executive Mike Sanders was back in the transit spotlight, announcing that negotiations with railroads for use of tracks were progressing, and he hoped to be able to send a plan to the voters in April.
My commitment's always been, without specific construction prices, specific right-of-ways, contracts signed, I don't want to put this on the ballot.
The plan involves a 1 cent sales tax to support the $650 million transit system. In Jefferson City, the House endorsed special elections to fill statewide office vacancies, such as will occur if Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder is the GOP candidate to replace Congresswoman Joanne Emerson. The bill would also prohibit temporary replacements appointed by the governor from running for the position. House Republicans swore it was not aimed at the Democratic governor, but House member Stacey Newman said,
since 1875, you know, the governor has been able to appoint regardless of when the vacancies occur.
Democrats call the proposal unconstitutional. Confirmation of Governor Nixon's appointment of Doug Nelson to head the Office of Administration was on hold after some Republicans heard Nelson had signed off on the Highway Patrol's purchase of a new airplane.
It was circumventing the legislature to purchase a new plane for the governor to fly around the state to have these press conferences. It's very troubling,
said Kansas City Senator Ryan Silvey. St. Louis State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal introduced a bill to require parents of Missouri school kids to notify their school district if they are gun owners.
The Second Amendment does not say that a 12-year-old can shoot a 12-year-old. There's no protection for that. What we are trying to do here is address what is happening in our urban cities.
But with GOP control of both houses, even Chappelle Nadal didn't believe the bill would pass. Kansas Governor Sam Brownback encouraged abortion foes at a Topeka rally.
Life is critical. Life is essential. Life is what it's all about. And that's why we need you here, and we need you to continue to push and to march and to pray and to work at pro-life centers.
The legislature seemed supportive of more abortion restrictions, but uncomfortable with Brownback requests to end tax deductions for interest and property taxes. In business news, HCA lost a $162 million judgment to a nonprofit who said the company's building new suburban hospitals didn't satisfy an infrastructure improvement promise HCA made when it started buying up Kansas City hospitals. And Hallmark's Bill Hall quoted a national study that decried job-poaching border wars in the Kansas City area.
To Kansas, of this job shuffle, is 595 jobs at a staggering cost of $323,000 per job.
No border wars truce was in sight. Going into the weekend, it was a pretty sure thing that GM's big news conference Monday morning would be about the expansion of its Fairfax plant. Still to be revealed were how much expansion and how many jobs will be involved. This is KCUR.
The The world premiere of the play Blacktop Sky at the Unicorn Theater marks a homecoming for the playwright. Christina Anderson grew up in Kansas City, Kansas, and eventually attended the Yale School of Drama. KCUR's Steve Walker has her story.
Playwright Christina Anderson knew about theater at a pretty young age and recalls how in middle school, her first visit to a play both opened her eyes and corrected a misunderstanding about the art form.
I believe the play was My Children, My Africa, and I think I was probably in seventh or eighth grade, and we went to go see that show. But it never really occurred to me that a playwright had written that play. I had read Shakespeare in high school, but, you know, he was, like, long dead, obviously. So it just never really occurred to me that there were living playwrights or a soul person who wrote a piece that then went on stage.
After seeing that show at the Coterie, her naivete was soon lifted by her involvement in that theater's Reaching the Right Minds program and its Young Playwrights Roundtable, where the theater's artistic director, Jeff Church, took her under his wing.
It blew my mind. It just never occurred to me that, you know, I, being a Kansas City, like, 15-year-old girl, could have the power, the access to write in that way. And, you know, like, the great thing about Jeff is that he wasn't going to censor us in any way, which was exciting when you're a teenager that you don't get censored. And I don't remember there being, like, a right way or a wrong way to write the plays. He was just really committed to us expressing, like, the things we wanted to say. So it was a real gift.
With her new play, Blacktop Sky, Anderson returns to the Unicorn Theater, where her first play as a teenage writer was staged. The Unicorn's Cynthia Levin recalls that Anderson was one of the more promising young voices she'd witnessed.
I mean, we all were just waiting. You know, what's Christina going to do with her life? Because there was so much promise. And she went off to school, and she went off to graduate school, and studied with Paula Vogel, who's one of my favorite playwrights. So I sort of always was tracking her. She sort of broke a lot of molds. She doesn't write what is considered a traditional play. She just takes a different look at different subjects and a different way to attack them and a different way to look at certain issues.
Blacktop Sky depicts a triangle between an 18-year-old girl, a mechanic, and a young man who's homeless by choice. Set in the public courtyard of a housing project, it addresses perception, suspicion, and motivation.
I'm not going anywhere.
Come on.
I didn't say that.
You're acting like it.
Don't grab me like that.
You want me to rub some dirty ass feathers all over? Is that it?
People already call you pigeon.
Is it important to you to give voice to characters who regular theater goers don't always get to see in their lives?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think one of the gifts, you know, that I've sort of received over the years is just reading a lot of plays and a lot of stories that do just that. And it's not even necessarily about, like, African-American or Black American stories, but, you know, just sort of access to seeing and hearing different kinds of people and seeing them on stage. It's empowering for me, personally.
Kansas City audiences now have the opportunity to gauge how accurate American Theater Magazine was when it called Christina Anderson one of the 15 up-and-coming artists whose work will be transforming America's stages for decades to come. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
Christina Anderson's play Blacktop Sky at the Unicorn Theater opened this weekend and runs through February 10th. For more information, visit the Arts and Culture section of our website, kcur.org. This season, the Kansas City Symphony has been exploring the intersection between visual art and music. It's a collaboration between the Symphony and the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, culminating in a new composition, which will debut next weekend. KCUR's Laura Spencer has the story.
At the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, modern and contemporary art curator Jan Schall stands next to Vasily Kandinsky's 1924 painting, Rose with Gray. There's a circle in the center and other geometric forms sliced by straight dark lines on a gold background. Schall says in Kandinsky's time, music was regarded as the highest form of art.
And artists were a little bothered by that because they wanted their art to be as pure. So what was it that made music live on that higher plane? And it was kind of the abstractness of it.
Shaw says Kandinsky called his paintings compositions or improvisations, and he put his notion of painting as music made visible into the stage design for a 1928 performance of Modest Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, musical interpretations of artwork by a friend who died young. It's an afternoon rehearsal for the Kansas City Symphony at Helzberg Hall. First up, Mussorgsky's Pictures, then Adam Schoenberg's Finding Rothko. The symphony's music director, Michael Stern, commissioned this work when Schoenberg was still in Juilliard's doctoral program, and it premiered with Stern's Iris Orchestra in 2007. Finding Rothko is on the program opening the Kansas City Symphony season.
Ladies and gentlemen, Adam Schoenberg, our friend.
I was living in New York, and I was always going to the museums, and that was also around the time that I discovered Mark Rothko. And right when I saw some of his paintings, they just spoke to me.
Let's jump back to the Nelsons, Associate Curator of Modern and Contemporary Art, Lisa Fanning. Her doctoral thesis on abstract expressionism, including the work of Mark Rothko.
The paintings that Adam focused on are really Rothko's classic or mature style paintings, and I would describe them as stacks of color, rectangular bands of color, the edges of which are all extremely ephemeral, so they seem to float. They're very, very atmospheric.
Fanning says the idea is that the viewer stands close to a painting. The colors surround you, much as music surrounds a listener in a concert hall. Composer Adam Schoenberg says there's a parallel between Finding Rothko, with four movements each inspired by a Rothko painting, and the new work co-commissioned by the Symphony and the Nelson. It's titled Picture Studies. Schoenberg walked through the museum's halls with curators, and also several times by himself, looking again for art that spoke to him in a personal way.
I want the music to stand on its own, and the paintings served just as initial inspiration.
There are 10 movements in Schoenberg's Picture Studies, inspired by artworks from the Nelson. A combination of sculpture, painting, and photography from the likes of Bloch, Calder, Kandinsky, and Blake.
And I selected a photograph by Francis Blake called Pigeons in Flight, which I think has four or five pigeons just in motion, and I find it really beautiful. And that is actually the last movement of the symphony piece.
Schoenberg leafs through tall sheets of paper, each line an instrument, and he makes quick notations in pencil.
And what's also funny, even when you have a score finished, every time you go back over to just look at the details, there's always something that you missed. Always.
Next weekend, the Kansas City Symphony debuts composer-in-residence Adam Schoenberg's Picture Studies, based on art at the Nelson Atkins Museum. We're hearing a section of that right now, based on a painting by Kandinsky.
Thank you.
This story was reported by KCY's Laura Spencer and originally aired back in September. To see some of the art in the Nelson that inspired the new work, check the Casey Currents page of our website at kcur.org.
Thanks for tuning in to Casey Currents this week. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org. Or sign up for our podcast. We're on iTunes. Contact us at caseycurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at Casey Currents.
Casey Currents associate producers are Alex Smith and Suzanne Hogan. Our interns are Monica Sandretsky and Zach Lewandowski. And theme music is by Approach. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Alex Smith. Susan Wilson will be back next week.